Chapter 87. Privacy and drank their beer. The members of the family and servants of the house kept away from the gloomy spot, where the bones of the descendant of an ancient line of knights and gentlemen lay, awaiting their final consignment to the family crypt. No regrets attended them, save those of the poor woman who had hoped to be Sir Pitt's wife and widow, and who had fled in disgrace from the hall over which he had so nearly been a ruler. Beyond her and a favorite old pointer he had, and between whom and himself an attachment subsisted during the period of his imbecility, the old man had not a single friend to mourn him, having indeed, during the whole course of his life, never taken the least pains to secure one. Could the best and kindest of us who depart from the earth have an opportunity of revisiting it, I suppose he or she, assuming that any vanity fair feelings subsist in the sphere whither we are bound, would have a pang of mortification at finding how soon our survivors were consoled. And so Sir Pitt was forgotten like the kindest and best of us only a few weeks sooner. Those who will, may follow his remains to the grave, whither they were borne on the appointed day, in the most becoming manner, the family in black coaches, with their handkerchiefs up to their noses, ready for the tears which did not come, the undertaker and his gentlemen in deep tribulation, the select tenantry mourning out of compliment to the new landlord, the neighboring gentry's carriages at 3 miles an hour, empty, and in profound affliction. The parson speaking out the formula about her dear brother departed. As long as we have a man's body, we play our vanities upon it, surrounding it with humbug and ceremonies, laying it in state, and packing it up in gilt nails and velvet, and we finish our duty by placing over it a stone, written all over with lies. Bute's curate, a smart young fellow from Oxford, and Sir Pitt Crawley composed between them an appropriate Latin epitaph for the late lamented baronet, and the former preached a classical sermon, exhorting the survivors not to give way to grief and informing them in the most respectful terms that they also would be one day called upon to pass that gloomy and mysterious portal which had just closed upon the remains of their lamented brother. Then the tenantry mounted on horseback again, or stayed and refreshed themselves at the Crawley Arms. Then, after a lunch in the servants' hall at Queen's Crawley, the gentry's carriages wheeled off to their different destinations. Then the undertaker's men, taking the ropes, palls, velvets, ostrich feathers, and other mortuary properties, clambered upon the roof of the hearse and rode off to Southampton. Their faces relapsed into a natural expression as the horses, clearing the lodge gates, got into a brisker trot on the open road, and squads of them might have been seen, speckling with black the public house entrances, with pewter pots flashing in the sunshine. Sir Pitt's invalid chair was wheeled away into a tool house in the garden. The old pointer used to howl sometimes at first, but these were the only accents of grief which were heard in the hall of which Sir Pitt Crawley, Baronet, had been master for some 80 years. As the birds were pretty plentiful, and partridge shooting is as it were the duty of an English gentleman of statesmanlike propensities, Sir Pitt Crawley, the first shock of grief over, went out a little, and partook of that diversion in a white hat with crape round it. The sight of those fields of stubble and turnips, now his own, gave him many secret joys. Sometimes, and with an exquisite humility, he took no gun, but went out with a peaceful bamboo cane, Rawdon, his big brother, and the keepers blazing away at his side. Pitt's money and acres had a great effect upon his brother. The penniless colonel became quite obsequious and respectful to the head of his house, and despised the milks of Pitt no longer. Rawdon listened with sympathy to his senior's prospects of planting and draining, gave his advice about the stables and cattle, rode over to Mudbury to look at a mare, which he thought would carry Lady Jane, and offered to break her, and see. Colin, the rebellious dragoon, was quite humbled and subdued, and became a most creditable younger brother. He had constant bulletins from Miss Briggs in London respecting little Rawdon, who was left behind there, who sent messages of his own. I'm very well, he wrote. Hope you are very well. I hope Mama is very well. The pony is very well. Gray takes me to ride in the park. I can canter. I met the little boy who rode before. He cried when he cantered. I do not cry. Rawdon read these letters to his brother and Lady Jane, who was delighted with them. The baronet promised to take charge of the lad at school, and his kind-hearted wife gave Rebecca a banknote, begging her to buy a present with it for her little nephew. One day followed another, and the ladies of the house passed their life in those calm pursuits and amusements which satisfy country ladies. Bells rang to meals and to prayers. The young ladies took exercise on the pianoforte every morning after breakfast, Rebecca giving them the benefit of her instruction. Then they put on thick shoes and walked in the park or shrubberies, or beyond the palings into the village, descending upon the cottages, with Lady Southdown's medicine and tracts for the sick people there. Lady Southdown drove out in a pony chaise, when Rebecca would take her place by the dowager's side, and listen to her solemn talk with the utmost interest. She sang Handel and Haydn to the family of evenings, and engaged in a large piece of worsted work, as if she had been born to the business, and as if this kind of life was to continue with her until she should sink to the grave in a polite old age, leaving regrets and a great quantity of consoles behind her, as if there were not cares and duns, schemes, shifts, and poverty waiting outside the park gates, to pounce upon her when she issued into the world again. It isn't difficult to be a country gentleman's wife, Rebecca thought. Think I could be a good woman if I had 5,000 a year. I could dawdle about in the nursery and count the apricots on the wall. I could water plants in a greenhouse and pick off dead leaves from the geraniums. I could ask old women about their rheumatisms and order half a crown's worth of soup for the poor. I shouldn't miss it much, out of 5,000 a year. I could even drive out 10 miles, to dine at a neighbor's, and dress in the fashions of the year before last. I could go to church and keep awake in the great family pew, or go to sleep behind the curtains, with my veil down, if I only had practice. I could pay everybody, if I had but the money. This is what the conjurers here pride themselves upon doing. They look down with pity upon us miserable sinners who have none. They think themselves generous if they give our children a £5 note, and us contemptible if we are without one. And who knows, but Rebecca was right in her speculations, and that it was only a question of money and fortune which made the difference between her and an honest woman. If you take temptations into account, who is to say that he is better than his neighbor? A comfortable career of prosperity, if it does not make people honest, at least keeps them so. An alderman coming from a turtle feast will not step out of his carnage to steal a leg of mutton, but put him to starve, and see if he will not purloin a loaf. Becky consoled herself by so balancing the chances, and equalizing the distribution of good and evil in the world. The old haunts, the old fields and woods, the copses, ponds, and gardens, the rooms of the old house, whereas he had spent a couple of years 7 years ago, were all carefully revisited by her. As he had been young there, or comparatively so, for she forgot the time when she ever was young, but she remembered her thoughts and feelings 7 years back, and contrasted them with those which as he had at present, now that as he had seen the world, and lived with great people, and raised herself far beyond her original humble station. I have passed beyond it, because I have brains, Becky thought, and almost all the rest of the world are fools. I could not go back and consort with those people now, whom I used to meet in my father's studio. Lords come up to my door with stars and garters, instead of poor artists with screws of tobacco in their pockets. I have a gentleman for my husband, and an earl's daughter for my sister, in the very house, where I was little better than a servant a few years ago. But am I much better to do now in the world than I was when I was the poor painter's daughter, and wheedled the grocer round the corner for sugar and tea? Suppose I had married Francis, who was so fond of me, I couldn't have been much poorer than I am now. Hegel. I wish I could exchange my position in society, and all my relations for a snug sum in the 3%. Consuls. For so it was that Becky felt the vanity of human affairs, and it was in those securities that she would have liked to cast anchor. It may, perhaps, have struck her that to have been honest and humble, to have done her duty, and to have marched straightforward on her way, would have brought her as near happiness as that path by which she was striving to attain it. But just as the children at Queen's Crawley went round the room, where the body of their father lay, if ever Becky had these thoughts, she was accustomed to walk round them, and not look in. She eluded them, and despised them, or at least she was committed to the other path from which retreat was now impossible. And for my part, I believe that remorse is the least active of all a man's moral senses, the very easiest to be deadened when wakened, and in some never wakened at all. We grieve at being found out and at the idea of shame or punishment, but the mere sense of wrong makes very few people unhappy in Vanity Fair. So Rebecca, during her stay at Queen's Crawley, made as many friends of the mammon of unrighteousness as she could possibly bring under control. Lady Jane and her husband bade her farewell with the warmest demonstrations of goodwill. They looked forward with pleasure to the time when, the family house in Gaunt Street being repaired and beautified, they were to meet again in London. Lady Southdown made her up a packet of medicine, and sent a letter by her to the Rev. Lawrence Grills, exhorting that gentleman to save the brand who owned the letter from the burning. Pitt accompanied them with four horses, in the carriage to Mudbury, having sent on their baggage in a cart previously, accompanied with loads of game. How happy you will be, to see your darling little boy again, Lady Crawley said, taking leave of her kinswoman. Oh, so happy, said Rebecca, throwing up the green eyes. She was immensely happy to be free of the place, and yet loath to go. Queen's Crawley was abominably stupid, and yet the air there was somehow purer than that which he had been accustomed to breathe. Everybody had been dull, but had been kind in their way. Tea is all the influence of a long course of 3%, Becky said to herself, and was right very likely. However, the London lamps flashed joyfully as the stage rolled into Piccadilly, and Briggs had made a beautiful fire in Curzon Street, and little Rawdon was up to welcome back his papa and mama. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.